Welcome to Copy Time, a podcast series on markets and economies from DBS Group Research. I'm Tamer Beg, Chief Economist, welcoming you to our 100th episode. So from February 2020 to today, over the past 3 years, we've spoken with a wide range of experts from around the world, sometimes in person, sometimes over Zoom, all with a single objective, which was to gain insights into the way markets and economies are evolving around the world. From global finance to climate change, pandemic to geopolitics, fintech to wealth management, economic outlook of China, India, United States, Europe, UK, ASEAN. We have covered a great deal, haven't we? I'm lucky to have my ideal dream guest for episode 100. His first time with us was on episode 8, when the COVID-19 pandemic was ravaging the global economy. He is none other than Professor Raghuram Rajan, Catherine Dussac Miller Distinguished Service Professor of Finance at Chicago Booth. Raghuram Rajan was the 23rd Governor of the Reserve Bank of India between September 2013 and September 2016. Between 2003 and 2006, he was the Chief Economist and Director of Research at the International Monetary Fund. Why is Raghuram Rajan our ideal guest? It's because we are undergoing momentous shifts on global monetary policy settings, and in my view, no one in recent decades has appreciated the complexities, interlinkages, and fault lines within global economics and finance as well as Dr. Rajan. Whether it was way back in 2005 when he warned about the buildup of risk in the global financial system, or in the past decade when he has offered several key insights into the impact of quantitative easing and transmission of monetary policy shocks, he has been prescient repeatedly. So here goes our conversation. Professor Raghuram Rajan, a warm welcome to the 100th episode of Copy Time.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I couldn't have thought of a better guest. I'm going to cut right to it because there's a lot to talk about. Let's start by talking about your view on the medium-sized U.S. bank collapses that we saw in March, especially the response of the U.S. authorities.
Well, I think the response of the U.S. authorities is somewhat predictable in the sense that they certainly are very worried about a cascade of failures. They're worried about panic. And they do understand that there has been a significant increase in uninsured sort of liabilities in the banking sector over the last couple of years, partly as a result of the enormous quantitative easing that has taken place. So the fragilities, if people start worrying about the safety of their deposits, are significant. Of course, even if they don't worry about the safety of their deposit, they worry about the interest rate they're getting. And the old sort of bank means of profitability, pay low rates on your deposits and get high rates on, you know, just investing it in safe assets. That kind of spread is no longer easily available, as you're seeing many investors look to money market funds. Even direct investment in T-bills has gone up as interest rates on those, you know, hit 4.5%, while interest rates on bank deposits, the banks are still trying to, you know, pass off 0.5% and 1%. So in that sense, there is not just a short-term systemic problem if the deposits remained uninsured, as investors would look for safety, but also a longer-term profitability problem with the banking system. I think the short-term problem has been dealt with by the implicit insurance of all deposits, but the longer-term problem still exists, and you're seeing some of it with some of the results that First Republic reported just recently. So this will take time to sort out. The profitability of mid-sized banks needs to be reassessed. And certainly there will be some situations where mergers will have to take place.
Your assessment of the implicit guarantee, is that the right thing to do? I thought we were not supposed to do these things because of moral hazard.
Oh, I think that the real problem is no authority now has the, I'm trying to find a word to say it, has the backbone or the risk tolerance to see what happens if they let entities fail. And this is a problem. I think we have, certainly for banks, gotten into the zone of riskless capitalism. Take all the risks you want, so long as you take it collectively. Neither the Fed nor the Treasury or the equivalents in other countries, we saw a rescue in Switzerland. They really don't have the willingness to see entities fail and perhaps precipitate a Lehman-like moment. And you know, the talk is the Silicon Valley Bank was not a bailout. It was in the sense that the federal government, at least ex ante, absorbed about $20 billion worth of guarantees, etc. And you know, it may turn out to be something which doesn't produce significant losses, but that's conjecture. At the point of rescue, there was certainly a bailout if you define bailout as changing the terms of the contract to the benefit of the private sector. There's a bailout of the uninsured depositors. So I worry. I hope this wasn't done because the depositors of Silicon Valley Bank were particularly influential, though one can have one's suspicions. The broader problem is entities make money in normal times, taking risks, and then throw the risks back to the government in bad times. And the government or the government-related authorities have not shown any willingness to sort of tell people, you took these risks, you must bear it. Yes, equity holders got wiped out, but the uninsured depositors got a free pass.
You used to be the head of the research department at the IMF. Subsequently, you've also been an advisor to the IMF. Are you surprised that the IMF did not make a big deal out of the implicit guarantee?
Look, the IMF has a lot of fish to fry at this point. and I think the bigger fish, it is an issue. And if the IMF was fulfilling its traditional role of pointing out when governments exceed their mandates, this would be one place. Of course, the immediate response would be, are you willing to take the consequences of a wholesale financial panic? And really, the problem with moral hazard, et cetera, arguments is that, yes, on the spur of the moment, maybe you're trying to weigh panic versus risk bailout, and bailout seems more attractive. But we never ask the follow-up question, which is, okay, do it this time, but what are you going to do to ensure you don't get into this situation where you're forced to choose between two really bad options? And that's where we do far less good a job. And I'll put this on the shelf for the moment. We must ask how we got into that situation where so many mid-sized banks had taken the risk they'd taken without the Federal Reserve or the IMF, other organizations noting it. And that's something to worry about. But on this other issue of what fish the IMF has to fry, I mean, certainly the debts of many emerging market countries, Pakistan, Sri Lanka in South Asia, but many in Africa. Those are pressing issues because people are really hungry, and some of these countries cannot afford Even basic sort of safety nets for their people. And that's pain and suffering. And that's something that the IMF and the World Bank have to step up more quickly and in reasonable measure. Of course, the big issue there is how do you negotiate the debt that these countries have down so what the IMF is putting in doesn't go out through the back door to pay off the creditors. And there, I think the negotiations with China are very important.
It is interesting. I was in Washington, D.C. during the IMF spring meetings a couple of weeks ago, and the Chinese definitely came armed with a lot of data to show how much relief they have offered to beleaguered countries on a bilateral basis. And the fact that they don't take or entertain a direct face value reduction, but they still entertain a NPV reduction, was their point that they are actually doing a lot of work. It's just not the way the Paris Club would like them to do it. Okay, I do want to keep this podcast on, so to speak, fault lines, but since you have brought up the debt restructuring issue, I might want to pick your brain for 1 minute. Do you think that there is a significant problem in terms of creditor uniformity in treating these developing countries, or do you think that's too much of a big deal? The essence of the restructuring is how much relief to give, and that is being given anyway.
I think the reality, which you just brought up, is that we don't have a good framework for deciding relief, right? All these debt sustainability assessments, you and I know, are there's a little bit of, there's a huge amount of subjectivity there.
Yes.
How much can the country afford to pay? What is the political capacity to pay? Those are assessments that are very hard to make. And of course, you know, push the debt out far enough, and you can always say, look, it has the ability to pay that, so there's no need for face value reductions. But these are all subjective assessments. And, you know, tell me a number you want, and I can produce the assumptions that will give you that number. I think that's one problem. The second problem is, you know, what is the framework under which we do the negotiations, the restructuring? You remember early 2000s, Ann Krieger had proposed the strategic debt reduction, SDRM.
SDRM.
And it went nowhere. It went nowhere. But I think it is high time we have a more explicit framework for debt reduction, which takes into account what the private sector needs are, but also who in the public sector has lent. And of course, one of the issues with China is who's public sector, who's private sector, and what debts will be recognized. There is a requirement that we recognize those who have lent, you know, for humanitarian reasons, close to the crisis. I mean, both India and China lent to Sri Lanka when it was running out of money to pay for fuel. Those kinds of near default loans might, as in debt in possession financing in the private sector, have priority over other loans because they are made for humanitarian purposes. But how do you distinguish loans made for humanitarian purposes versus loans made for white elephant projects which benefit your own country or were made for the wrong reasons? That is something also we need to think about. And finally, how do you prevent countries that get debt relief from borrowing up and getting into debt trouble all over again? I mean, if you remember, in the early 2000s, again, we had a tremendous amount of debt relief, partly as a result of private sector pressure. But then these countries, some of them have borrowed up back to debt distress again. So how do you sort of ensure that countries keep space for necessary borrowing going forward? Because there will be crises. They keep coming. Sometimes the price of fuel, sometimes the price of food, sometimes it's war. But we need to keep space for that. And somehow we don't seem to recognize that the world is getting more volatile and climate change is going to just increase that. So I think there's a whole rethink needed, and the Chinese have to be part of the discussion, as do many prominent emerging markets. So they don't feel the framework was made in the West and benefits Western creditors, and that's it. It has to be a holistic discussion. I think, you know, many have been talking for a long time for the reform of the multilateral system, and it's high time we had a dialogue on it.
Feels almost inappropriate to go back to discussing quantitative tightening after such momentous issues that you've just flagged. But I will actually go back there. But your points are, of course, super critical and important. We are recording this in late April. And as you said earlier, with the First Republic Bank, the issue of deposit flight is back in the headlines. And you also pointed out that the regulators have to choose from a bunch of bad options. Well, what should they do now?
Well, I think the first thing is what they've already done, which is give depositors some assurance, at least in the short run, that nothing bad is going to happen to them. Otherwise, you could have panics, and you don't want panics to add to the steady flight of deposits from the banks. That said, I think the second part is really a very, very careful assessment of this balance sheet situation of banks. And this, fictional distinction between hold to maturity and available for sale on assets is I think, part of the problem. Trying to figure out how much is in what and then trying to estimate values in each. I think we need to come clean on all that. I in this day and age of mark to market, it seems that, assets that can be easily marked to market, I don't know why they should not be registered as such. But going forward, I think also there's the issue of losses on long-term assets. You know, one of the problems with First Republic is mortgages that are long-term. And obviously the value when they were made at rock bottom interest rates is very different from their value today. And that difference has to be financed. Earlier, you could assume that First Republic's depositors would accept a miserable rate of interest and be happy with it. And so essentially, it had stable financing at low interest rates for the long-term mortgages it had contracted. That's no longer the case. So I think we need a bank-by-bank assessment with, especially for the larger banks, some sense of backup financing in case they have, they're not able to raise the equity that they need to bolster themselves, but also, pressure for them to consolidate with other banks if necessary to deal with the problem. So this kind of cleanup needs to take place sooner than later. Otherwise, you'll see the steady flow out.
During my trip to Washington earlier this month, I also heard about non-bank related concerns that, the banks may well be the first domino and their brokerage houses and asset managers, perhaps even private equity, where these duration mismatch and mark-to-market losses could be potentially destabilizing. What are your thoughts on non-banks?
I think that's exactly right. Now, of course, there are non-banks and non-banks. Some have the equivalent of the potential for deposit runs. There are some arguments that ETFs have that kind of feature, for example. Mm. But there are others who, if not deposit runs, could have more slow burning runs. The tremendous period of low interest rates and the search for yield has undoubtedly created some situations of extreme duration mismatch. And the question is, can that be absorbed by the equity of the institutions, or does it sort of play into runnable debt? If it's equity and debt, resolution is possible. Losses will have to be absorbed in the system. But if it is more runnable, then you have the potential for much quicker sort of resolution by the markets, which then becomes much more painful and creates the possibility of fire sales in certain areas. So one of my conversations, I too went for the meetings, and I remember a conversation in November, in the October-November meetings of the World Bank and the IMF, when I met a money center bank CEO who basically said, "I think stuff is going to happen. I don't know where." And this was somebody who was well positioned to know where the flows were, et cetera. And I think that is really part of the problem, right? That you know when interest rates move up so quickly, you know when asset values change. And of course, we haven't seen the stock market change significantly. We've seen credit tightening, but we haven't seen it sort of go off the cliff. But when these things happen, accidents are bound to happen somewhere or the other. People have taken long positions. Now, where, how, and what will be needed to put the flames out, I think we need to think. But again, I would go back to, we cannot sort of avoid asking the question, how did we get here? And that's where I keep thinking that we need to look longer term at the consequences of really aggressive monetary policy.
Okay. Could not have drawn up a better segue than that for my next question, because you have been thinking about that issue and you've been writing about it along with Viral Acharya and others. So for the benefit of our listeners, you've written a series of papers in the last couple of years on the potential destabilizing effect of quantitative tightening. Would you be able to walk us through your reasoning and concerns?
Sure. Very quickly, I mean, we looked at the last episode of quantitative easing. Remember, there were three in the US, QE1, QE2, QE3, followed by a period of when nothing really happened. They stopped QE3 in 2014 and then started, they let things sort of run off. But I think they started selling and reducing the balance sheet significantly only in 2017. But that was quantitative tightening. And so the question really is, does central bank balance sheet expansion and contraction have significant effects? And from the monetary policy view, I mean, clearly the expansion of the balance sheet was somehow intended to give oomph to monetary stimulus, and the idea was they didn't quite know how it worked in theory, or they knew how it worked in theory, but were trying to find out how it worked in practice. In theory, it sort of worked by sort of taking out duration from the market and forcing the market to look for duration, and the hope was as the market looked for duration, it would finance also some long-term projects, and that would generate a whole lot of activity. I mean, that's portfolio balance in summary. Did that happen? Maybe not, but there was certainly a significant search for yield, which led to a repricing of some financial assets. At least, presumably that was part of what was going on. And it led, perhaps some banks to take on more duration risk. What we saw when quantitative easing happened was that, this notion that it has no effects, it has basically portfolio effects. It turned out it had more. That is, the banks were not just holding the reserves. After all, the banks have to, the reserves have to be held largely by the banks. But given that they had such liquid, low-yielding assets on their balance sheet, they were actually financing it first with demandable claims, many of them uninsured because they had to raise a lot of money in short order. But also, they ran down their time deposits. And this is both over time, but also in the cross-section. The banks that got more of these reserves basically ran down their time deposits more. So they were actually taking on more liquidity risk because the cost of financing these reserves was, you want to do it in the cheapest way possible, and the cheapest way is demandable claims. The other thing they did was they wrote demandable claims off their asset side, contingent lines of credit, for example. We will support you, firm, with liquidity as and when you want it. And so firms went out then and borrowed from the markets, backed up by this contingent line of credit, which the markets wanted to feel comfortable to lending longer term to the banks, to the firms, so that the firms would have liquidity when they needed it. So a whole ecosystem emerged around this sort of liquidity that the central banks were putting into the system, and basically it consumed that liquidity. It wasn't that it was free excess liquidity. It had been eaten up by demandable claims, by lines of credit, et cetera, that the commercial banking system had written. Of course, you can imagine that the shadow banking system also wrote some of this itself, but also depended on the banks for some of that liquidity. So what happened then was that when you withdrew this liquidity in quantitative tightening, it wasn't that, operated with $50 billion of reserves in 2007, we're now at $2 trillion of reserves, so we can go reduce reserves a lot without the system backing up. The system had essentially responded by eating up all the reserves in a sense that you were willing to supply. And as you brought down reserves, it turned out, first, the banks didn't bring down demand deposits, didn't bring down the lines of credit. And second, very quickly, the system backed up. It started showing signs of liquidity stress. December 2018 was the first example, but September 2019, when all hell broke loose in the repo markets, in treasury markets, and the Fed basically recognized that the system wasn't willing to tolerate a reduction in reserves beyond a certain point. And it came back even before COVID. The Federal Reserve was back pumping the markets with liquidity starting in September 2019. Federal Reserve Bank of New York was doing this. As you got into the COVID pandemic problem, again, markets started backing up. And again, the Fed pumped the system with tremendous amounts of liquidity. Now, the Fed's balance sheet went up to 8 to 9 trillion. And of course, bank balance sheets also expanded significantly. But our point was that this is not a this is not something which has no effect, because as bank balance sheets expanded again, you had the Silicon Valley banks essentially raising demand deposits in a huge quantity. Remember, 97% or so of its deposits were demand deposits. And of course, as they raised the money, they had to figure out where to put it. And you know, if you have 100 billion of extra deposits, 1% additional interest rates means $1 billion of profits in the year. That's something no CEO will sneeze at. And hang the duration risk, especially if we don't have a chief risk officer who's pounding on the table and saying we can't take this. And you take that kind of risk. So this time around, the tremendous amount of money did not just create, you know, sales of liquidity from the bank. It also led to more malinvestment. Important point. The same kind of poor investment decisions were also observed in 2017-18 when the Federal Reserve withdrew liquidity. You can see losses showing up on bank balance sheets. But because the Fed's balance sheet expansion was much smaller at that time, the losses were much smaller and weren't of a magnitude to tank banks. This time, not only were interest rate rises more, but bank balance sheet exposure was significantly higher because the Federal Reserve had expanded its balance sheet hugely, forcing commercial banks to expand their balance sheet hugely. And therefore, the losses in the banking system were significantly higher. And this is where the FDIC says, look, even on securities, the HTM securities, that $600 billion worth of losses to be absorbed in the system, those aren't going away. But in addition, of course, on long-term loans, there are also significant losses. The system, if you mark to market, is significantly less well-capitalized than we thought.
Absolutely. So is the lesson from quantitative easing and tightening that this grand experiment to combat deflation and zero bound should not have been pursued to begin with?
I keep going back to Mr. Shirakawa, who used to be the governor of the Bank of Japan. And he keeps saying, which I think is right, that mild deflation was never a problem in Japan. Because if you look at Japanese productivity, you look at Japanese growth adjusting for the shrinkage of the population, it's not bad over this period. Galloping deflation is a problem, but mild deflation, the system can handle. So the panic over the zero lower bound in the US and in Europe, that this is somehow going to lead to galloping deflation and will be hugely problematic, was not really a problem. I mean, in a sense, of course, what is the counterfactual? Could it have happened? Yes, you can't rule out the possibility it could have happened, but it never did happen. Not even in Japan. And so the real question is, was it worth bringing out this bazooka of quantitative easing without fully knowing what the consequences would be, including prompting the tremendous search for yield, which has left the financial system, despite all the increase in regulation post-global financial crisis, once again in a position where it needs to be bailed out. At least in parts. I think that is worth re-examining. I mean, what did QE buy us and what was the cost? The problem is, I think the macro, and I don't mean this as a blanket censure, but we really have two sides looking at central banking today. One is the macro monetary policy side, which has for a long time paid less attention to the financial stability side. And in fact said, oh, financial stability, will take care of it through macroprudential regulation and supervision. That is a neat separation, except it doesn't work. The monetary policy authorities look at monetary policy from the perspective of activity and do whatever they need to enhance activity. And the macroprudential / supervisory side takes care of financial stability. But if you're pressing on the monetary accelerator or, you know, inflating central bank balance sheets, it has consequences that the other side finds hard to deal with. And this easy separation that, you know, the monetary economists suggest is actually a figment of their imagination. And I think that what we need to do is recognize that the two sides are sort of joined at the hip. And therefore, what that would suggest is, yes, we may have just one instrument or one and a half instruments, but let's use them carefully, recognizing they have both monetary as well as financial stability effects. In other words, central banks should not once again escape blameless from the kinds of travails that the financial sector has. Yes, incentives in the financial sector. Yes, the problem with supervision. But no, the central banks are not blameless.
Not at all. Okay, so speaking of central banks not being blameless, this was a few years ago, I think it was 6-7 years ago, you wrote about the notion of spillback. And your point was that the U.S. Federal Reserve, when it lifts its monetary policy, it has ripple effects with the global economy, which then spills back into the U.S. in the form of lower demand for U.S. exports. So therefore, there's a magnifying effect. Do you still adhere to that view? And in light of that view, where do you see U.S. Federal Reserve's current stance? Is it appropriate? It's already gone a bit too far?
My point there was not so much that the spillbacks were big. I mean, the U.S. is a continental economy, and right now, any reduction in demand would actually be beneficial for the U.S., given where it is. But it was more that when central banks set monetary policy, and this is not just the Federal Reserve, but any other reserve currency central bank, it is basically, given its domestic mandate, thinking primarily about the rest of the world only in terms of spillbacks. How does our action eventually spill back to us from the rest of the world? The problem, of course, is that the rest of the world cares about spill forwards. The first effect of those actions. So, example, the traditional worry when the Federal Reserve raised interest rates was capital would flow out of receiving countries. The capital that was so easily available in when the Federal Reserve was following accommodative policies. From the Federal Reserve's perspective, all it needed to care about was the slowing in activity in the recipient country and its effects on the U.S. And to the extent that the U.S. was in a tight demand situation, those spillbacks were, in fact, not even problematic. They were beneficial to the U.S. because they reduced aggregate demand. And therefore, the U.S. didn't have to pay attention to the fact that perhaps tightening at that point might create financial sector problems in the receiving country, might create a tremendous drop-off in demand, which would be very hard to re-energize over time. In other words, the timing was entirely that of the U.S., and the U.S.'s domestic mandate made it think only about that. Now, I don't know what the answer to this is, because obviously the U.S. will say, you know, we're not the world's policeman. I mean, it turns out the Federal Reserve is the world's central bank. But I think the issue is we need to have some sense of, that we are worried about the spill forwards also, because spill forwards have tremendous effects, low economic activity in a recipient country, a country recipient of capital flows, can lead to a whole lot of things that have more permanent effects, including political change. And so we have to be, I think we need a better dialogue given how integrated the world is. Now, it may be that peak integration we've passed. I don't know. But certainly that dialogue is worth having.
Right, indeed. So I think I remember Ben Bernanke's reaction to your spillback. I hope I'm not misstating the person who said it, but Ben Bernanke's point was that he can barely estimate spillover within the U.S. and spillback is just too hard and therefore might as well not try to figure it out. But I appreciate your point that it's not just about estimating the spillover's actual impact, but the dialogue and the cognizance of that is very critical. Speaking of Ben Bernanke, he brought inflation targeting to the Federal Reserve, and then subsequent governors have also talked about doing monetary policy through the various stars, including our star. Have the inflationary developments of the last couple of years rendered these 2% inflation target and our star monetary policy, all these things moot for the time being?
Surprising as it may seem, basically think that, inflation targeting is not a bad concept. I think, in its original form, we want to target this level of inflation over the medium term, and we want to be held responsible by the public or by the government to achieving this target. It is a very clear sort of assessment of what the central bank is supposed to do. And I think in hindsight, we will see that certainly the 1990s and the early 2000s were a period of relative calm when, focusing on the knitting, focusing on keeping inflation under control relative to the 70s and the 80s was a good thing for the global economy. Certainly, we grew in the 2000s strongly before the global financial crisis. That said, I would add to it a concern about financial stability. I do think we need to keep both financial stability as well as inflation in mind when setting monetary policy. But that also tells me that, let's not be overly ambitious about elevating low rates of inflation unless it moves into galloping deflation. And again, I recognize that, how does one tell whether it can move into galloping deflation other than saying that, we haven't seen that happen in developed countries, perhaps since the Great Depression. So I think the point here is that I think we were overly exercised about low rates of inflation. And that gave both central bankers, but also policymakers outside central banks, the ability to say, oh, we're not hitting inflation targets, we should do more. And then we got into all sorts of aggressive fangled ideas of old fangled ideas about buying government debt and buying corporate debt and so on, all of which, to my mind, are probably likely to be a step too far for central banks. Focus on the knitting, focus on using monetary policy to keep inflation below a certain level and try to prevent galloping deflation, but don't worry excessively if it's 1% and not 2%. That doesn't give you carte blanche to essentially go out and lend to everything that moves under the guise that you need to elevate economic activity. You then start doing things that you have absolutely no capacity to do effectively, and you set up problems for the future. So I wrote a piece in the IMF called Less is More. And basically, I think central banks should go back to the knitting. The point here is, worrying about the zero low bond and low inflation may have been excessive and opened the door for central banks to do far more than, we have confidence they can do.
Okay, so that is in the context of developed market central banks. Is your prescription for emerging market central banks also that they should adhere to inflation targeting independent of the overshoot of the last couple of years?
Well, I think for many emerging markets, the real problem still is high inflation. And so they're in a somewhat different position than the developed countries. The point I was making about being circumspect about what you can do was the problem seemed to be, at least for a while, very low inflation, and then they were trying desperately to elevate it. That's not a problem that India faces or Brazil or Mexico face or have faced for any length of time in the last so many years. And so the real problem for them is how do we keep inflation under control? And to bring down high levels of inflation, I think inflation targeting has been a fairly good instrument and has been a very clear way of communicating with the public, this is what we need to do and this is what we are going to do. So I would not abandon inflation targeting in a hurry in those countries.
Point taken. Okay, final question. I hope it's not an unfair question. What key financial and economic risk factors would you be tracking as the cycle winds its way through 2023?
Well, I mean, I certainly think, you know, one of the issues we need to keep looking at is credit at this point. You know, how credit tightens, what the consequences are. Clearly, the last the couple of years during COVID, when bankruptcies fell tremendously in industrial countries and in a variety of emerging markets, suggest that there are potential losses that are waiting to happen. Zombie companies that have been supported during this process. And we will see some of those consequences as credit tightening takes place significantly for the first time. So credit markets worth looking at, credit spreads worth paying attention to. So that's one place I would look at. Certainly in the short run, the stock prices of banks will be a clear indicator of what the sense is and what's going on. There are more ready and timely indicator of the health of some of those banks. Of course, they're not as good as being able to go inside, but that we don't have the luxury of doing. So those are a couple of indicators I would look at. Of course, inflation is still a big issue. And there is some hope that if indeed there is a credit tightening in the economy, it will slow the economy enough to bring down inflation. But right now, that is conjecture. The worst of all possible worlds is you have the credit tightening, you have the slowing, but inflation still doesn't come down because it is localized in some sectors where there's still relatively strong demand and there is a strong push for higher wages. I'm sitting right now in London, where, of course, one of the big fears is that people haven't, their wages haven't kept up with inflation. And therefore, they're actually significantly worse off at this point. And so, you know, it is hard not to sympathize with workers demanding higher wages. So at least to ensure they don't slip back in terms of their livelihood. So, I mean, lots of forces coming out. I mean, we're talking just financial market. I mean, of course, the big sort of issue for the world is the rift between the United States and China and how that will play out going forward. Hopefully, no further adverse measures on both sides and some attempt at dialogue between them. But that's something we have to cross our fingers and hope takes place. And of course, we have an ongoing war or many ongoing wars and how they play out is also important. So lots to keep abreast of.
Absolutely. Okay, before I let you go, I'm sorry, it's not the last thing because I just wanted to hear your view on the commercial real estate issue in the U.S. Do you worry that's a big simmering time bomb?
It is. I mean, prices, especially of office properties, will have to adjust, right? And rents will adjust as, you know, companies deal with the fact that they no longer have all their employees coming to work. That said, I mean, it may be. So one of the things you see companies doing is 2 days off, 3 days on. But those 3 days are the same for everyone. So as to build up camaraderie in the office and so on. But if that's the case, you pretty much need this, you know, much the same office space as you had before. On the other hand, if you say, okay, this group will come in on Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and that group on, I mean, if you can spread it out, maybe you need less office space.
That's what we do.
How that plays out, I think how, you know, behavior norms readjust I think is worth examining. It may be, I mean, as you know, I don't know what DBS is doing, but a bunch of banks have asked people at the senior level to come back. Once the senior level people come back, the junior level people know FaceTime is important and they start showing up. So I think this is work in progress, but I think that the net effect is going to be somewhat lower demand for office space. And therefore, offices, especially the old style offices, are going to be a problematic asset. In the US, this is more concentrated in small and medium banks. And therefore, those real estate losses will start showing up in addition to the losses they already have on their securities portfolio. Again, it varies by bank. It, you know, who has more exposure, who has less exposure. I think we have to wait and see what happens.
Well, on that sobering note, Raghuram Rajan, thank you so much for gracing our 100th episode.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to our listeners too. Kopi Time was produced by Ken Delbridge from Splice Studios. Daisy Sharma and Violet Lee provided additional production assistance. Kopi Time is for information only and does not represent any trade recommendations. All 100 episodes of Kopi Time are available on YouTube and on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, and Spotify. As for our research publications, webinars, and live streams, you can find them all by Googling DBS Research Library. Have a great day.